You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Can we be so sure that peace and stability on our continent are assured beyond any shadow of doubt? Is that a risk worth taking? I would never be so rash as to make that assumption.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron says that a vote to leave the EU could increase the risk of war in Europe. Is he right? Or is this a warning of six more weeks of pre-referendum scaremongering? My guests Nina Schick and James Rogers will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including North Korea turning out to be about as keen on independent reporting as you'd expect, Moscow's Victory Day parade commemorating the last war or preparing for the next one, and... Tony Abbott, because that's who they were cheering, became better known for downing beers and indeed onions than enjoying a quiet glass of red. So why has the former Australian Prime Minister's wine list caused a domestic political row? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Rogers, Senior Lecturer in Journalism at City University in London, and Nina Schick, Director of Communications at the London Office of the EU Policy Think Tank Open Europe. Welcome both. We will start with this.
The serried rows of white headstones in lovingly tended Commonwealth war cemeteries stand as silent testament to the price that this country has paid to help restore order in Europe. Can we be so sure that peace and stability on our continent are assured beyond any shadow of doubt? Is that a risk worth taking?
I don't think the Prime Minister can seriously believe that leaving the EU would trigger war on the European continent, given that he was prepared only a few months ago to urge that people should vote leave if they failed to get a substantially reformed European Union.
The British Prime Minister, followed by the man who wants to succeed him, they're trading blows over whether Britain leaving the European Union could make a war more likely as the nation steels itself for another 6 weeks. Another 6 weeks, God, of this sort of thing prior to the referendum. David Cameron says he thinks the EU has been a guarantor of stability, whereas Boris Johnson, the recently superseded Mayor of London, believes that the EU is a force for instability and alienation. Nina, first of all, they cannot both be right, obviously. Are either of them really entirely wrong, though? And is this the problem?
Exactly. There's, you know, hints of both of them, what they're saying, there's hints of truth in it. I think the reality is, with this campaign, and we have six more weeks of this to endure, it's really
turned... Please stop saying six more weeks.
It's really turned project fear versus project fear. So on one hand, you have Boris's side saying, you know, if we don't leave, we're going to... The 70 million Turks who are just about to join the EU, they're going to flood into our country and it's going to be disaster. We're going to be pulled into some super state. And on the other hand, you have David Cameron today. He didn't say there'd be war, but, you know, strongly hinting at that. And I'm quite surprised at that, actually, that he made that argument, because so far they've taken, mostly it's been about the economic argument, about what this means for the country's prosperity and jobs and housing and so on. And because the British public is quite sceptical, the war, the peace and stability argument is something that's popular in countries like Germany, but not necessarily in the UK. I haven't really heard people use that argument to defend the EU and the UK. So it really shows you how they're ramping up the rhetoric ahead of the referendum, because project fear sells.
It does rather put me in mind of one of my favourite ever front pages on the Daily Express, a somewhat excitable British middle market tabloid for our listeners unfamiliar with it. Angela Merkel gave a very similar speech a few years ago, which the Express greeted with the front page headline, Germany warns of war in Europe, which I thought was rather a classic. James, do you think that, and again to invoke the six more weeks phrase, that part of the reason that the debate has reached this point is a worry on both sides that people are becoming quite bored with the whole thing and therefore they're having to ramp up the rhetoric?
Yes, but it is an interesting departure from Mr. Cameron in the sense that the argument about war has been made a lot in France and Germany historically. It's been made less in this country, and that's often put down to the fact that this country wasn't actually occupied occupied during any of the big conflicts of the 20th century.
Apart from the Channel Islands, before anybody writes in.
There is that, yes. And that's often put forward as a reason why the argument that the European Union or some form of European cooperation as a guarantor of peace in Europe has never quite carried as much weight in Europe, in the UK, as it had in other parts of Europe. So in that sense, it's quite interesting. I mean, Mr. Cameron, he obviously talked about the conflicts of the 20th century, but he went back much further to the 15th, 16th, 17th century, really trying to put this in some kind of historical perspective. And certainly interesting, too, that both of them talked about Winston Churchill. And it was inevitable, of course, that the wartime prime minister was at some point going to make his appearance in the campaign. Rather like many religious texts in the world, it seems it can be interpreted, and his speeches and writings can be interpreted to suit whichever cause one wishes to advance.
In this country, there is never a political argument or indeed a pub quiz without Winston Churchill appearing somewhere. And Nina, though, is there a reasonable point here in that, as James points out, David Cameron was taking a very broad historical sweep, making the point that the 70-odd years of relative peace, give or take the Cold War and Bosnia since World War II, are a blip in European history. Other than that, it is a fairly ceaseless orgy of the Europeans hacking lumps out of each other.
I think if the UK were to leave the EU, I don't think that the rest of the EU would descend into World War III. I think the big, you know, there's always NATO, which is also a very important stabilizing force in the Western world. I think the bigger risk is that if Britain leaves, there's going to be so much navel-gazing between the UK and the rest of the EU as to what the new trading arrangements are going to be. 40 years of trying to figure out how people are going to travel, et cetera, et cetera. All of that, that they're going to take their eye off the larger picture, which is what's happening in the Middle East, North Africa, and Russia. And that, I think, is the real... I think that's the real risk factor if there is a Brexit in terms of security.
Just to follow that up, though, Nina, that point you're raising there about what might follow an outvote, why is it, do you think, that the Remain campaign aren't making more of what you could tactfully describe as the pain in the neck factor? That whatever you may think about the EU and whatever benefits you may think may ultimately flow from an outvote, the process of negotiation that would follow an outvote, it's going to be a colossal, interminable pest, isn't it?
I think they are making that argument. Maybe it doesn't cut that much sway, though, because it's not a very sexy argument. If on the outside it's couched in terms of this is, we're patriotic, we're seizing our future in our own hands, come on, believe in yourself. Boris today said, we can see the sunlight on the other side of the meadow. And if the in camp is just making the argument that, oh, we shouldn't leave because it's going to be pain to do it, and it's going to be 10 or so years.
This may be bad, but it could be worse.
Exactly. Which is that argument. And I think they are making it, perhaps that doesn't cut so much sway than this patriotic pro-Brexit argument that we see Boris making today.
Okay, well, we do have, and that phrase again, 6 more weeks in which we can talk about this, unless we've all decided to emigrate as a consequence. So let's look now at a country where the public discourse is rather less confrontational on the grounds that there isn't any. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea has taken issue with the reporting of Rupert Wingfield Hayes, the BBC reporter who had been among foreign reporters given a visa to cover the first Congress of the Workers' Party for 36 years. Wingfield Hayes and his team, having upset the officials in Pyongyang, have now been ejected from North Korea. James, I don't think we should probably tarry too long with taking seriously or otherwise the various accusations North Korea has made against the BBC team. Should we assume that this is a warning to the rest of the foreign press contingent currently in North Korea?
Yeah, I think in one sense it is, but in another sense it's a little hard to fathom why they let them in the first place, really, because, I think... the North Koreans do watch, certainly the elite watches what goes on in the outside world. They know what kind of Western journalism is, with its pluses and minuses. And they know that it prides itself on ideas of impartiality, of independence and so on. I mean, one can argue about the extent to which those are always achieved. But that aside, they know that this is not, one of the cornerstones of journalism, particularly in the English-speaking world, is this idea of speaking the truth to power. So you go and you find things, you see things as you find them, and you tell people about that. So, yes, it's a warning. I mean, I would imagine, and I do know Rupert Wingfield Hayes, actually. We both used to be BBC Moscow correspondents together. He's a great correspondent. He was a great colleague.
Is this the first country he's been thrown out of? Because that is quite a badge of honour for any foreign reporter. As long as you're not roughed up too much, you do want to be deported at least once.
Well, that's right. I think in this case, I have been detained myself in Russia a couple of times, and you're not too concerned about when that happens about being thrown out. What you're more concerned about is being kept in, to be honest with you. And I would imagine particularly that would be the case in North Korea. You know, if you go to work somewhere like that, there's a risk that something like that may happen, but really what you'd be worried about was if you were put on trial and actually jailed there. But thankfully that hasn't happened on this occasion.
I have myself only ever been thrown out of one country. A big hello to all our listeners in Cameroon. Nina, journalists going to North Korea know to an extent what they're going to get into. To what extent, if you're in somewhere like North Korea, a place I've never managed to visit myself despite several attempts, to what extent should you acknowledge that you are basically covering a dog and pony show put on by the regime?
I think it's absolutely right what he did. And I'm surprised that all he got was 8 hours of intense questioning and then was allowed to leave the country. We know, I think, was it recently the story of the American student who became like a show? He went on trial
Indeed.
In North Korea and got sentenced to many years of hard labor in a prison in a North Korean camp. So, of course, there's a risk. But, I mean, what's the point of doing it if you're not going to push the boundaries at some point as a journalist?
I think from some of the reports that I've seen of this trip, which is accompanying the Nobel laureates on their visit there, it's absolutely fascinating because it's a country, you know, Andrew, as you say, you've never visited. I've never had the opportunity to. I know a few people who have as undercover journalists. Nobody really, very rarely able to go openly. People go under other guises. But it is very interesting for us as outsiders, the country about which so little is known, it's so difficult to visit, there's so little media coverage from outside organisations. So I think even the smallest insight, even under the restrictions which are obviously placed on visiting correspondents, is very interesting, I think.
I mean, yeah, as both of you have said, it does seem actually weird that the North Koreans invited so many foreign press and then appear to be surprised when the reporters have gone about attempting to report on things. As far as I can tell, though, and this my survey of North Korean official media may have missed a few bits, but there is nothing in Rodong Sinmun or the usual places about this. So the North Koreans don't appear to be admitting to other North Koreans that they've had to toss the BBC's correspondent. Wouldn't there be, at least from their point of view, and Nina, I'm hereby inviting you to, you know, pretend to think for the regime in Pyongyang, which is always fun, but wouldn't there be some mileage for them in making a thing out of it? They could perhaps, you know, have called him a capitalist running dog.
Perhaps they could have. I'm surprised they didn't. I mean, but I guess they just, who can say what's behind their reasoning? Didn't the North Korean government also tell the people that they won the World Cup?
Quite possibly.
That would
be among the very least bizarre things that North Korean media has suggested in recent years.
There's another thing here, though, Andrew. It may well be they'll decide to do that. I mean, I don't think in North Korea, they don't have the hectic 24-hour news cycle that's common in most other parts
but
of the world.
You make a fair point.
The government has total control over the media, so they may decide to sort of, you know, talk about this in a couple of days' time, because after all, people probably have very little access. Even if this is all over, you know, the BBC, it's all over a lot of other international media, and I would imagine it's probably very widely supported and reported in South Korea too, but the audiences in North Korea have no means of getting independent information on this, so it may well be that they're going to use this and say, look, we got tough with these awful capitalist journalists and slung one of them out just to show we mean business.
Just to follow that up, James, do you think there, I mean, you know, and I've worked, I understand it's usually almost invariably much, much more difficult for broadcast journalists, especially television journalists. As a print reporter, it's a lot easier to give people the slip or operate under a certain amount of subterfuge, which I've done in various places where there's a certain amount of official scrutiny. But is it possible, and I think North Korea would be the ultimate test case, where you would be so constricted and so supervised and basically so hassled that there is simply no point in going, and that actually the journalistically responsible thing would just be to say, look, seriously, this is just a waste of our time?
I mean, I think with North Korea, really, it's the rarity value. If you were invited to go to Pyongyang every week, then yes, I think it would be exactly like that, because you'd know what was going to happen. But because this happens so infrequently, anything that you can get at all, even if, you know, you can be there for days before, you know, without actually actually getting a story. Just the pure rarity value. You know, it's like it was when Western crews 25, 30 years ago were first allowed unprecedented freedom of movement in the Soviet Union. You know, just seeing what a school was like, what a market was like, had a real sort of wow factor. And so I think probably, but if these invitations came every week and you got the same dog and pony show, as you say, then probably it wouldn't be worth it. But because they're precisely because they're so rare, then I think it still has that, you know, gee whiz, this is news factor.
What do you think, Nina? Is it the case that we know so little about North Korea, and we do know so little about North Korea, it is speculated about a great deal, it's very rarely actually reported on. Is anything we can learn worth learning?
Absolutely. I've watched some documentaries of people, you know, going undercover and trying to film what they can. And although they know that this is a very controlled tour, it's still fascinating as a viewer or trying to understand what's going on in this country. And the same goes for, you know, these journalists trying to get in there. Isn't the North Korean regime also opening up to tourism? They let in a certain amount of tourists,
that comes and goes with the tides.
With the times, yeah. So when I spoke to someone who had been on one of these tourist tours, you know, I thought it was fascinating, and I think it's still a worthy cause.
Yeah, and also when you see, I mean, as was an example last week, there was another BBC correspondent who'd taken a photograph which included one of the North Korean leaders, but he hadn't framed it properly, and he got in terrible trouble. And the minder, the foreign ministry or the information ministry minder or whoever was with them, took his phone away, and she was visibly angry. And I think that was quite an interesting insight into the way the media management works as well, because it seems unbelievably crude. Again, if you're going to let Western reporters in, you might have taken the time to consider just how clumsy that's going to look in terms of spin. You're snatching somebody's phone away. Not sort of going up somebody saying, well, I wouldn't be putting it quite like that myself.
You're right. It is a telling image. But do you think, and just a final thought on this, not necessarily about North Korea, but anywhere that journalists are officially hassled and pestered in this respect, that it's just, I guess, a question of balance? Because again, when it's happened to me, and I've not been a news reporter, I've been a feature writer, so you can make the secret policeman following you around part of the story. Just write him into it.
Yeah.
But do you think even like a state news journalist, or a straight news journalist rather, has to be careful to acknowledge at all times that this is a Potemkin village I'm reporting from here?
Yeah, I think you do. You have to be absolutely clear about the circumstances in which your report is being made, you know, and say that you're subject to the restrictions, because otherwise you're not really being honest with your audience.
Okay, well, you are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Mullen, Nina Schick and James Rogers. We are going to take a short break now. Coming up next, it has been revealed that Tony Abbott spent a fair bit on wine when he was Australia's Prime Minister, which you may think would explain a fair deal, and also Russia's Victory Day Parade.
Monocle's freshly made May issue heads beyond the city fringes to look at village life. We look at the best hamlets and small towns for design, architecture, business and more. Plus, there's our glorious design directory to help you sharpen your life. Here's what our editors have discovered.
In the design section, we visit three rural outposts crafting unique products. From a furniture HQ in the wilds of Bavaria, to a pottery enclave in Kaishu, and a Dutch village turning out some of the finest tiles.
In the edits pages, we find respite in new hotels from Rio to Amsterdam and a prospect for property in the highest state capital in the US, Santa Fe.
The May issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Get your copy today or plan ahead with a Monocle subscription at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Nina Schick and James Rogers. Now, a happy Victory Day to our Russian listeners. May 9th is the anniversary, at least Russian time, of the surrender of Nazi Germany in 1945, a capitulation paid for in no small part in Russian blood and treasure. At least 20 million Soviet citizens perished during World War II. The date is understandably sacred to Russians, and this year's commemorations have included a notably old-school parade in Moscow, including 10,000 troops, 135 military vehicles, 71 aircraft, nuclear missiles, and lustily bellowed patriotic songs. Nina, Russia, say whatever else you may about it and its regimes, has always put on a terrific parade. Is there any subtext here, or is this just Russia doing as Russia does on Victory Day?
No, I think there clearly is a subtext, and that is all you have to take it in the context of Putin's geopolitical adventures, shall we say, in Ukraine and Syria. And the reason why, I mean, obviously, this is, like you said, this has always been a very, very important day for Russians, given their history in the Second World War, how traumatic it was, how it's imbued in almost every family and their in their family histories. But this is also another reason for Putin to amp up this nationalism, which has seen his ratings go skyrocketing up ever since he did the invasion of Ukraine. Before he launched the Ukrainian invasion, he was at about 61%, his approval ratings, which sounds very high in a Western
context.
There's
a lot of Western leaders would trade for that.
Well, yeah. Hollande was on 13 last week, so yeah, I think Hollande would happily switch places. But nonetheless, they're at 83% now. And this was, you know, this skyrocketed after, again, this the whole Syrian incursion, the Ukrainian invasion, this this narrative that it's us versus the West, you know, the patriotism appealing that to that. And interestingly, a lot of Russian people feel that the economic destiny of their country is not going as it should. So less than half of Russians believe that the economic situation is going well, but they separate that from Putin. They don't see him as responsible for that. So he's almost become, you know, not a politician who can simply be removed with the passing of time, but he's become so central to the state that he looks certainly there to stay.
James, as you were saying earlier, you worked in Moscow. You must have seen variations on this before. Mm. Is it still worth doing the old school thing of carefully scrutinizing the reviewing stand and seeing who's standing closer to the General Secretary than they were last year?
Well, I mean, judging from the expert analyses that have been published on today's parade, actually, that seems to be really coming back, particularly from the point of view of military hardware. It was a very sort of not quite who's standing next to Putin, but certainly look at the military hardware was on show. A lot of military experts have been doing that today because it's material which has been used in Syria, which may be deployed to Kaliningrad and so on. So it may have actually a sort of strategic significance which it hasn't had. Now this, you're absolutely right, is quite a long tradition, but it was only in 2008 that the tradition of having military hardware was revived.
Because they gave it a miss for a while,
they
didn't
did. They stopped at the end of the Soviet Union. They revived it in 1995 because that was the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. And they had it then. But that was very much a sort of nostalgic thing. But then 2008 was the first time they had the tanks and the missiles across Red Square again. So it's very much, in that sense, very much a Putin-era tradition and very much a modern one. Of course, in 2008, of course, it was only a few months later that Russia went to war in Georgia. It was a few months after the Victory Day parade that Russia was at war for the first time since the end of the Soviet period outside its own borders.
Nina, do you think we still underestimate the degree to which Russia's experience of World War II informs the view of the West it still has? I mean, I think maybe it gets forgotten because obviously World War II was an immense catastrophic trauma for all of Europe. And so it seems, I guess, vaguely idle to compare one catastrophic trauma to another. But in terms of basic mathematics, it was worse for Russia and the Soviet Union than it was for anybody else.
Yeah, and obviously there's an element of history being rewritten here as well, because when you see, you know, the kind of language that's used at Victory Day Parade or indeed to justify any of Putin's excursion into the rest of the world, they do it in the language of the Second World War, conveniently admitting the part that Stalin played, you know, and how he actually, you know, he was an ally of the Germans before the Germans turned on Russia. And, you know, when they started the invasion of Ukraine, they referred to, you know, the fascists. And even with Syria, they were saying this is a anti-terrorist alliance, like the alliance against Hitler. So I think it is very, very collectively ingrained in the Russian society and imagination.
One exciting innovation in this year's parade, James, was the march passed by the newly formed National Guard. This is this sort of apparently as many as 400,000 Interior Ministry troops who will report directly to the president. Now, even if this isn't quite the NKVD under another name, how sinister or otherwise a development is this?
Well, it's an interesting question. I was last week at a conference of Russian EU journalists, and this actually came up as a point of discussion. And there was a feeling that to some extent this is for show. I mean, even if there is going to be discontent in Russia, Nina is absolutely right that while Putin has very high personal ratings, there is a good degree of discontent, actually. And it's going to be interesting to see what the Russian parliamentary elections in September throw up, because while these aren't universally free elections, they do give a sense of what people are thinking. And the precise question which came up, is this possibly going to be about quelling some domestic discontent by force? And it was generally agreed by the experts at this conference I was at that that's probably not the case yet, but nevertheless, it is there. It's a sign very much of state power.
Okay, well, finally tonight, on an altogether lighter note, any suspicions that being Prime Minister of Australia and or Tony Abbott would be sufficient to drive a fellow to drink appear to have been confirmed. After a long, dogged campaign by opposition politicians who have the luxury of living in a country somewhat strapped for more pressing concerns, Australia's Information Commissioner has directed the PM's office to release the bottle shop receipts of its former occupant. We have learned that Mr Abbott's staff spent $7,340 Australian dollars on wine and beer between February and April last year. This is about £3,500, give or take. James, it's for private and official functions at the Lodge, the residence of the Prime Minister of Australia. I don't know what the bar tab at one of these wingdings really runs to, but is $3,500 over 3 months that big a deal?
I mean, it doesn't actually sound that much to me. I mean, assuming that he's entertaining delegations there, trade delegations from other countries, diplomatic delegations.
Pause at the thought of Tony Abbott entertaining anybody. Well, at least deliberately.
I mean, one is really reminded of the admission that to the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair made in his autobiography about the worst thing he did was to introduce freedom of information legislation. Because, and also one wonders about the news management of this entire thing. One imagines if this had just been given out at the time when the request was first made by a senator, as far as I remember, then it would not have been allowed to spiral into the huge issue which has subsequently become.
Well, the thing that struck me, Nina, and I'm biased, obviously, in favour of the wines of my homeland, which are very, very good. But aside from, he was serving, and I've looked this up, he was serving the Clona Killer Hilltop Shiraz at about $35 a bottle, which is not bad at all. But it does seem to be actually quite a parsimonious hospitality regime they were offering. The other vital information that has been discerned by this campaign is that the current prime ministerial cellar, supervised by Malcolm Turnbull, has 370 bottles in it worth an average of $25 a bottle. This is like £12.50 a bottle. And you can probably go, well, actually, in Australia, that is pretty much the second cheapest bottle in the shop.
Yeah. First of all, why is this even a story? Second of all, what kind of plonk is he serving the visiting dignitaries? I mean, you would imagine he might have to have something a little bit more supreme than that to, you know, do his business. I mean, come on. He's the prime minister of your country. Of course he has to entertain visiting diplomats and dignitaries. He should have wine, and probably should have a little bit better quality wine for more important occasions as well.
is Australia missing a soft power opportunity here, James?
Well, it sounds a bit like it. I mean, Andrew, you know, if the wines really are as good as you say, and you know, it sounds like they probably are by selling some of the...
Why do you doubt me?
No, not at all, man. I mean, particularly if they're serving something towards the bottom of the range, you know, people who are, you know, going into the shop and looking by price rather than by quality, then presumably, you know, visiting international dignitaries should be treated to some of the finer drops, I would have thought.
I mean, Nina, this is a transparent exercise in the host asking the guest to confirm his own, you know, thesis here. But does this sound to you like, frankly, the concern of a country whose polity and press have not all that much else to trouble themselves with?
It certainly sounds that way. I can't imagine that being a story here. But having said that, as we were discussing before, the MPs scandal certainly, the MPs expenses scandal in this country certainly raised some temperatures as well. So perhaps this is the Australian equivalent. Though I can't imagine that normal Australian people would be that outraged
by this. And from a journalistic perspective, James, is this the kind of thing you would clear a front page for?
Probably not clear the front page. I think I'd probably run it though. I mean, I think
would you would you clear a quarter page under the fishing results on page 72?
Well, probably somewhere in between, I think. I mean, but if you think about it, you know, there are good ways of spinning this. You know, if times are hard for somebody, you know, wouldn't you like $3,000 to spend on grog at your house?
Not if I had to drink $3,000 worth of $12 a bottle plonk, not necessarily.
I mean, in a sense, this is also a story about scrutiny of public officials and who has the right to know what in this data age, I suppose. But it's journalistically, I mean, I think, yeah, on a slow day, I think it would get in.
We will have to leave it there. James Rogers and Nina Schick, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Giusti. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next. 1900 Hours. Rob Bound is in with the Culture Show. You can hear more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.